This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Anthony Hamilton. He is the author of Mind, Time, and Power, Using the Hidden Power of Your Mind. Anthony, it's great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks, Robert. It's great to be here.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilliter.
Hi, guys. It's nice to talk again.
So, Anthony, your book is about using the hidden power of your mind. Just to kind of start things off, do you want to give us like your brief biographical information? You were a college professor for quite some time.
Yeah, that's right. I was a basically a business teacher, business English, writing, speaking, doing presentations, that sort of thing. I worked in Vancouver, and I also worked in China from 2005 until 2009. And so basically I was teaching people how to write, how to speak, how to put together presentations and that sort of thing. And I'm very fascinated by language because I have a linguistics degree from university. And to me, linguistics is a branch of cognitive science. And it gives us a way to look into our thinking processes. So I think that, language is a great tool to give us an insight into how people think. And of course, oftentimes, it's well known that that a lot of psychological counseling really comes down to just talking and listening, right? So the language that people use gives a real insight into what their beliefs, what their feelings are, what their self-image is, and that sort of thing. So I really enjoy teaching language, and I really enjoy teaching about the mind.
There's always this whole sort of concept of using the full potential of our mind, and we only use a pretty fairly small percentage of that. That's sort of the key theme of your work, is utilizing the full potential of one's mind.
Yeah, not necessarily the full potential, because who knows what the full potential really is, but certainly using more of our mind. I mean, psychologists now have ways of looking inside the brain as people are thinking, using something called a functional MRI. They can watch people think in real time. So there's been a lot of discoveries made and a lot of research since about the mid-90s, actually going back farther, but around the mid-90s, they discovered a couple of really remarkable things about what thinking is and how the brain works. And so in terms of the work that I do, it basically comes down to helping people realize some of the unconscious thought processes that they have going on, which might be beliefs or feelings or emotions, and helping them deal with those, helping them change those perhaps, so that they can use their thinking in a more constructive, more helpful way.
So all these concepts, they're backed up by science and physics?
Well, yeah, that's true. And but a lot of them have been around for a long time, For example, in the mid-90s, using this functional MRI, the scientists discovered something that was truly remarkable, and as far as they were concerned, it was impossible. Because what they discovered is that the brain can change. It can continually grow new neurons and new neural connections, something that's now come to be known as neural plasticity. And before the mid-90s, or certainly in the 80s, you know, that was considered impossible. When I was in university in the 80s, studying psychology, the basic understanding was that the brain doesn't change that much. You know, it develops to a certain point, and then it starts to lose function and lose neurons. And the idea that you could change your brain was truly a radical thought. I mean, it was considered to be impossible. And the idea that they've discovered now that you can change your brain and you can influence the way the brain develops just by thinking in a certain way, that's truly radical. And that's this new science of neuroplasticity now. But the truth is that I read about this in books that were written over 100 years ago. Back then it was called metaphysics, you know, positive thinking. People were talking about things like the law of attraction. And there's a very famous book that came out, and also a movie came out about 10 years ago called The Secret. And it's based on a series of books by a guy named Wallace Wattles. And if you read his books, which were written around 1900 or so, he says right in that book that you can develop any talent you want, you can develop your brain in any area that you want just by thinking in a certain way that he describes in this book. So the idea then that you could change your brain, change the nerves in your brain by thinking in a certain way, the idea has been around for at least 100 years that I know of, but it was always considered to be ludicrous. It was just ridiculous, you know, until lo and behold, in the mid-90s, using a functional MRI, scientists discovered that it's true.
Is there also talk about this kind of theme of cybernetics, using of engineering one's brain? Are you interested in that topic as well?
Yeah, that's not something I know a lot about, but of course I've seen some shows and I've read some articles and things about it. And as a matter of fact, I was watching something on the news recently where a woman who had gone blind regained some of her sight because they planted some kind of a photosensitive chip in the back of her eye. And so this chip was wired into the visual cortex in her brain, and it allowed her to see, or at least start to see. So there's all kinds of research on various aspects of technology now taking place. And so getting back to the functional MRI again, just for a moment. So there's two things that they discovered which were equally remarkable, I think. The first one is the fact that your brain is plastic, and not only does it change, but you can influence the way it changes. The other one is what they call mental time travel, which is the theme of my book. And so mental time travel actually refers to the fact that what we normally think of as memory works in the future too. So we're normally used to thinking of memory as kind of a recording of past events. But what they found is that when people imagine the future, the same parts of the brain light up. So now they're using terms like future memory and mental time travel, and as a matter of fact, if your listeners were to go to Google and type in mental time travel, they'd find that there's tens of thousands of research papers now written on that topic. So the idea that the mind works in the past and in the future equally is really the theme of my book, and that's something that was proven in 1995.
You were saying in a previous interview you did that you actually had a dream, I think, when you were a kid, that connected to your adult self. Is that what you were referring to by mental time travel?
Well, yeah, this is something that happened to me when I was 10 years old. And I just turned 70, so this is 60 years ago, you know. And so my experience was I fell out of a tree. I was swinging on a rope in a tree with some friends of mine. I fell out of the, you know, my hand slipped off the rope. I landed on the ground and kind of knocked myself out, knocked the wind out of myself. And for a moment there, I felt like I was in a helicopter looking down at myself at the age of about 32. That's what it seemed like. And so in that flash of insight, or that epiphany, or that precognitive experience, you know, whatever you want to call it, I felt that I knew what my life was going to be about, that I was going to be writing, I was going to be teaching, I was going to be working in universities, and I was going to be helping people be happier and more successful. And so that launched me on a 20-year search to find out some reasonable, logical explanation to how it's possible to get information from the future. So I finally figured it out to my own satisfaction. I developed this model of the mind based on quantum physics from our friend Albert Einstein, and which I said, and I started teaching about this in 1980, before I'd ever heard of mental time travel or the functional MRI, I started doing workshops and things on using your mind in the past and in the future. And what I found is that the key to using your future memory, as you might want to call it, is to decide what it is you want your future to be about. The people that are most able to use their mind effectively to create more of what they want in their lives are people that set goals on a regular basis, you know.
So basically, as goals are what you're saying, is that what future memory is?
That's an aspect of it, yes. So when you start setting goals and you decide what it is you want to do in your life, your mind starts to function in a little different way. You start to get intuitions and feelings and hunches and ideas popping into your mind. And in my book, Mind, Time, and Power, I say that this is your future self communicating with you. So, you know, right now, if I think about my 10-year-old self, that doesn't seem very special. We say, well, that's just memory. You know, anybody can remember that. But if you think about thought being a connection, which is now what the scientists are saying, that if I'm thinking about the past, I'm now connected to the past, the same as we're now connected. You and I are connected through the internet. So it starts to make sense that if that 10-year-old child, that 10-year-old me, is available to me now, I have information from that person, well, it makes sense then that he would have some information about me. And of course, the idea that people get a glimpse of the future and decide what their future is going to be, I mean, stories about athletes doing that and business people doing that, you know, they're everywhere. I mean, I was watching an interview just a couple days ago with Phil Mickelson, you know, who's a champion golfer. And he said that he used to pretend in his mind that he was playing, you know, championship golf tournaments when he was 10 years old, putting around in his backyard. And of course, now he's doing that, and he can remember those 10-year-old feelings and ideas. So he first of all, you know, dreamed about the future, and then he created it. And this is what we can all do. But the problem is, what I've found in my research is that only about 3%, from 3 to 5% of people, really set goals. I mean, religiously, you know, carefully. Most people simply don't, because of their belief system, perhaps, you know, it's hard to say. But about 95% of the population doesn't really sit down and decide what they want their life to be about. But the people that do, their mind starts to operate in a different way and gives them insights and information about how they can create the life that they want.
You were talking about the dream experience you had when you were a kid, and then was there a period where you struggled a lot through life, and was there a turning point?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, I had this dream, this vision, this whatever you want to call it, when I was 10, and so I knew, you know, quote unquote knew, that I was going to be a university teacher, I was going to be writing books, I was going to be speaking to people, teaching people how to be successful and happy. So I assumed, you know, that I was going to have a pretty easy life and everything was going to just be simple and I was golden, you know. And what I found was just exactly the opposite. For some reason, I had a heck of a time in high school. I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder. I got in trouble with the teachers. I ended up not quite failing out of high school, but my marks were so bad that I couldn't go to university. So that dream that I had about being a university professor seemed to evaporate, you know. So this made me very angry and frustrated, and the chip on my shoulder got even bigger. And so all through my late teens and 20s, I traveled around trying to find work, you know, working on construction and trying to sort my life out, not very successfully. And for me, the turning point came when I was about 29 years old. My relationship with this lady that I was going with broke up. We had a four-month-old daughter. I got fired from my job, and I had no place to live, no money, no relationship, and I was really bummed out and depressed. And here I was thinking, you know, I'm supposed to be this successful person, you know. And so for me, the turning point came when I saw this advertisement for a course in the power of the mind. And I thought, this is it. This is for me. You know, this is what I need. This is what I want. I want to learn how to use the power of my mind to turn my life around. So I took this course. This was 1979. I remember I spent $750 for it, which was my last EI check. So it's all the money I had in the world. And I was desperate. I needed to make something happen. So I said to myself, I'm going to take this mind power course and I'm going to study it. I'm going to do every little exercise that I'm given in this course. And I started doing this 20-minute visualization exercise every day. So I learned how to meditate, visualize. I did this 20-minute visualization exercise according to the instructions in this course every day, didn't miss a day for about 6 months. And at the end of 6 months, my life had changed, you know. I had some insight now. I knew about the law of attraction. I knew about the power of the mind. I knew about visualization. I knew about goal setting. And I developed some confidence. And shortly after that, I started speaking and teaching and doing coaching on the principles of success. So that course, which you might call a meditation course or a mindfulness course, visualization course, that was the turning point for me. And within a couple of years, I'd written the book, and I was making my living as a public speaker, teaching people about the power of the mind.
That's interesting, because I have flashes, actually. This might sound really weird, and we could be talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. And I realize there's a lot of negative energy to that. For example, I remember just listening to records, you know, in my basement, my parents' basement, and just playing on, like, records of just old jazz records and such like that. But when I was about to put on this one record, I had a flash about an old relationship I had, and I couldn't listen to this brand new album, and I just had shock. I had to go out of the house. I had a bike. I felt it again, like overnight. Like, it was really weird and stressful. And as you were saying, like, certain events of the past, I was just wondering if it can be negative for someone who has post-traumatic stress disorder. Is it trying to tell somebody about their future? Is it a warning, or is it more something of a positive thing? Because I don't know where it stands on something that is someone running away from their traumas, or is your trauma trying to tell you in this other light that you should have a more progressive light? You know, it's just, you know, your fears, rather, you know?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. You know, we all have things in our life that cause us pain, right? I mean, if you talk to a lot of people that are afraid of dogs and you say, why are you afraid of dogs? It's not unusual to find them say, well, I was bitten by a dog once when I was a kid, you know, and ever since then, I just am afraid of dogs, right? As a matter of fact, I'm afraid of horses for that very reason. A friend of mine and I were feeding this horse apples one day, and we ran out of apples, and I guess the horse got a little anxious, so he bit my friend's ear and nearly bit it off, as a matter of fact. And ever since then, whenever I look at a horse, all I can see, you know, are these big teeth. But in terms of stress and trauma, the reason that we have these negative emotions attached to things, I mean, aside from the fact that something traumatic might have happened to us, you know, is because of the meaning that we attach to it. So if we learn to think about our past experiences in a different way, and it just means, you know, telling ourselves a different story about it, or asking ourselves some questions, you know, why could this be a positive thing? We will find the positives in it. And I believe that our past is recreated each moment as we think about it in the present. And when we think about our past in a different way than the past shifts, you know, the meaning of our past shifts. And of course, there's all kinds of stories, you can think of them the same as I can, about, you know, people that have a relationship breakup, or they get fired from a job or something, you know, or they're in an accident and it's a terrible thing for them. And then, you know, a year or two or three later, they look back and they say, you know, actually that was a positive experience because it forced me to make some changes in my life. And now I'm a better person, you know? So the past, is changeable. It's malleable, and we can change the past simply by changing what it means to us.
Hmm. Yeah. That's interesting because, I view it so much in a negative lens, especially at young people today. They have breakups with their, like, boyfriend, girlfriend, and you always think to yourself, well, as you said, at that young age of 20s, it's like, is it ever going to happen again? And yeah, I think the same way too in my own self as well. It's funny because the music I want to listen to seems to be the most traumatic free thing, but being in a total environment where everything is bliss seems to bring back memories of bliss that didn't work out. And again, right. I could see, and that's what I'm trying to explain is, yeah, I think that actually works as long as you take the trauma and make sure it's not a negative, because I always have these demons in my head about like certain, like, especially in college, of people making fun of me. But I always now feel that as long as you envision that, but not in a traumatic way of jealousy, could you actually obtain it? That's what I'm getting.
Yeah, that's
at.
Right. And, yeah, that's right. And of course, we're all kind of programmed too, you know. So we have these automatic habits, you know. Like I say, I was trained as a linguist, so I can use the analogy of a language, right? And you know, if you hear somebody who was raised in Germany, for example, you know, they might have a German accent. So that accent is still going to be there. That's in a sense a trait from their past, right? So I think we all have these traces of emotional hurts or emotional damage, you might even say, from our past. And a lot of those things linger on and really shape the future. So it's really important for each of us to take control of how we think about things and to try and figure out some way to look at the past, look at these negatives, that as we call them, in a different light, you know. And as we do that, we find that we gain some ability to transform the way we think about things. And as we change the way we think about it, we change the way we feel about it. And each of us really is responsible for taking charge of our own past, the negatives that we've experienced in our own past, and trying to shape them so they become more neutral or perhaps even positive, you know. On the other hand, I believe also that anything that is important to us in our life in the future makes itself known to us in the past in some way. You know, we'll have a hunch, we'll have a feeling, we'll have an intuition, we'll have a dream or a vision or something. And Phil Mickelson, you know, pretending he was a professional golfer when he was a kid. So I was talking to somebody, because I still do some teaching and coaching here, and I was working with a fellow recently who was from South America, and he wanted me to help him get rid of his accent so he could be more easily understood, you know. And so that's what I was working on him, or, you know, working with him on. And so he asked me about, what am I doing, you know, and I said, well, I have this book that I wrote, and I'm doing speaking and stuff around this book. And he said, what's it about? So I told him, and when I got to the idea that I just mentioned, you know, that I think that anything that's important to us in our lives makes itself known to us early in our life, he started to cry. And I said, hey, William, you know, what's going on? This guy is a 40-year-old businessman studying in Canada, you know. And he said, when you said that, I just remembered that when I was a teenager, I told myself, one of these days when I'm a grown man, I'm going to move to Canada with my family. And he said, I totally forgot about it until you just mentioned that just now.
As far as daydreaming goes, there is this concept called maladaptive daydreaming, where you spend most of your time fantasizing. So daydreaming is something, it can be both a positive, constructive force, but it can also be a distraction.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Well, daydreaming really is the key to your power, you know. But it's, as you said, there's two kinds of daydreaming. I mean, there's daydreaming where your mind is sort of taking control and your imagination is just whipping back and forth in the past and the future and all, you know, negatives, what could happen or what might happen or what did happen or what's possible to happen, you know. And there's also daydreaming where you have control over it. And that's really what I'm talking about with mental time travel. It's the idea that controlling your daydreaming, you know. So controlling in the future would be, you can call that goal setting or life design. And in the past, we could talk again about healing your past, you know, changing some of these past negatives or past negative attitudes, trying to work with them and heal them to develop a more positive view of your past. So daydreaming is, on the one hand, the most natural thing for us to do. Everybody does it. But also it's the most powerful thing when we learn to control it. And I guess the key, you know, one of the keys certainly to gaining control of our minds is meditation. And of course, meditation now, it's a thousands of years old practice, but it's becoming more and more well known in the West here. And, you know, there's meditation classes and mindfulness classes every place you look, it seems like. And so for people to learn to control what they're thinking about through meditation and focused awareness, that's really the key. So you get some control over this, you know, monkey mind, as they call it in the East, rather than letting your imagination just go willy-nilly all over the place. Try and get some control over it, you know, and when you can learn to direct your thoughts, then you gain some ability to direct your life.
And just based on observations of my own daydreaming, I found both to be true. I found sometimes it can be a distraction, but it's also helped me achieve goals if it's led to new ideas, and it, especially coming from a creative background. As far as meditation goes, I've noticed that with meditation, it does bring back a lot of memories from the past. But then there's this whole concept called transcendental meditation. And I was listening to a talk by David Lynch, and he was saying that we pretty much, you have your conscious brain and your subconscious, and transcendental meditation is a way to connect the two and get more in psych with your subconscious thinking.
Yes, that's right, exactly. So the key then is to gain some control over it, right? Because otherwise your mind is just all over the map all the time. Now, of course, someone like David Lynch, if you're talking about the film director, you know, here's a person who is a professional dream creator, right? I mean, he comes up with a fantasy for a movie and then step by step creates it in the real world, you know, using actors and script development and perhaps millions of dollars, you know. And so this idea of turning a dream or a thought into physical reality, it's really exciting, and it's the thing that I'm most interested in helping people do, or at least get some ability to do, by learning how to decide what it is they want, what kind of attitudes do they want, what kind of feelings and emotions do they want to feel, and then teaching them some techniques and learning how to do that so that people systematically become more positive, with higher self-esteem. They have a little more confidence. They're more clear about the road that they want to take into the future, and they have the ability then to visualize and plan and take action towards those plans and goals so that they eventually create their dreams and their goals as physical realities in their life.
So would you say one of the main core root causes of low self-esteem is not having control over one's goals?
Well, I suppose there's as many answers as there are people, but probably the story that we tell ourselves is really, I think, the cause of low self-esteem. I mean, if you have a difficult childhood, if you're bullied, you know, or if you have some negative experiences, and you give those the meaning that you're not good, you're not good enough, that the world is an unsafe place, that you don't have what it takes, that you're missing some essential piece, you know, of course, that's going to lead to low self-esteem. And but if you tell yourself that you're a strong person, that you have the ability to learn, that you can overcome difficulties, you have the same ability as anybody else, you know, anybody else who achieves a goal, you can copy them and achieve your goals too, then your self-esteem will systematically grow. But just getting back to this analogy that I spoke about a few minutes ago of thinking as a kind of a language, you know, that person that I mentioned a minute ago that was born in Germany, you know, if his name happens to be Arnold Schwarzenegger, he may never be able to get rid of his accent, even though he's been living in the States now since, I think, 1970. So he's been here for 40 years. And as I understand it, spent a lot of money trying to get rid of his German accent. He still sounds pretty German. You know, when you hear Arnold's voice, you know who it is, right? So in some way, our early programming, whether it's linguistic or whether it's attitudinal or feeling or emotional, it has a way of sticking with us. You know, we all have our own challenges and our own burdens to bear, some, of course, bigger than others. But at the same time, we can improve and we can shape, as Barack Obama says, we can shape the future. So I think it's a great idea that we can cultivate and shape the future. And I like the analogy of gardening. You know, anybody can understand that a person can take a piece of ground and turn it into a botanical masterpiece by cultivating and weeding and seeding. And we can do the same thing in our life, you know, by systematically deciding what we want and taking steps in that direction. We can develop a stronger self-image, more confidence, more ability, more courage, and more clarity. And by deciding on what we want our life to be about, we can approach the reality of that vision. The same as you created this podcast out of a dream that you had or a thought that you had, and now here it is, a physical thing. You know, you and I are speaking over the internet. Each of us has the ability to literally create more of what we want if we take charge of our thinking.
You know, this is very interesting. I've learned this behavior through something called metapolitics, which is this ideal that politics don't change unless people have philosophies and ideologies to talk about politics. For example, that if there's one policy, you have to be in office to change it. But rather, if people are on the internet talking about this, then this consensus of younger people or people's consciousness changes the values, and then those people in power will change their minds because of metapolitics. It also has to do something with memes. And I guess with the internet, they call it meme culture. Somebody shows a joke online and they start spreading the meme, and then everybody becomes this universal consciousness about memes, and it becomes real. And I really think people don't have the words and memes by it, but this sounds a lot like that people can also have, you know, light magic or chaos magic. And I guess light magic would be this ideal of being positive, you know, having a, if I was to be more happier about myself or to create something of happiness and, you know, good faith, and then I get good karma back. But if I was to do something like really negative, and like, let's say I start a death metal band, or I get really negative and I don this punk rock image, then everything's chaotic. It's chaos, and you draw evil in your images. I mean, do you think there's this some kind of ethical background to it, or is it pretty much universal and it doesn't really have to do that much with ethics? Because it seems like there is this one, like, they'll tell you, like, such as Christians will tell you, this is the good way of thinking. But then let's say, like, the Church of Satan with Anton LaVey will say, well, there's also a negative way of thinking. And then as long as you think evil, evilness comes true. I don't know if there's any magic of ethics in that to say.
Well, again, you know, I'll go back to linguistics because that's my training and that's my sort of meta model for everything, right? And I also studied philosophy, so I have a degree in philosophy and linguistics. And I look at philosophies, and of course religions are just a branch of philosophy. all religions are just a kind of language. You know, they're sort of a belief language or a thought language, you know. Now, nobody would say, hey, German is the true language, you know, and if you don't speak German, there's something wrong with you because German is right and French is wrong. Well, of course, that sounds ludicrous, you know. But people often say, well, my belief system, my religion is right and your religion is wrong. And, I mean, wars are fought over that idea, you know, all the time. And really, from one perspective, you know, you take this sort of 10,000-foot view and you realize it's really kind of silly over arguing what things mean, you know. And yet, as human beings, that seems to be what our fate is, you know. We all create individual meanings, as we've been talking about for the last half an hour or so, you know, things being negative or things being positive or things being possible or things being impossible and things being right and wrong. They're just different aspects of how we see the world, you know. So we can certainly change. Each of us has the power, I believe, to change our world. Whether or not I can change your world, that's a whole other thing. And it's interesting that you brought up this idea of politics, because it's not something that I really have any facility with or any experience with, but obviously there are certain people, you know, that have the ability to persuade other people and lead other people and, you know, sometimes create miraculous things, you know, whether it's a Martin Luther King or a Mahatma Gandhi, you know, one person can have a tremendous influence on the way the future develops.
You were touching upon Albert Einstein and quantum physics. There's this whole concept of quantum consciousness where basically time exists on one plane. This ties back to your theory about mental time travel, where time is connected on one existing plane rather than separated.
Well, the way that I understand, and Einstein, you know, studying Einstein's work gave me some great insight into answering the questions that I originally started with, which were, how is it possible to get information from the future? And when I was reading some of his work and reading about him, you know, he said that time and space don't really exist independently. They exist together in a four-dimensional space-time matrix. So he said, what's true of space is true of time. And so I thought, well, what is it that's true about space? And I realized, well, information travels through it. Exactly, that information is traveling from me to you and from you to me right now, you know? And so I thought, if information travels through space and space and time are mirrors of each other, which is what Einstein said, then information must travel through time as well. And I realized this is how I can get information from the future. If I think of that vision I had when I was 10 years old as a connection to the 30-year-old that I was dreaming about or that I had the vision about, then it makes perfect sense, because everybody knows that a 30-year-old can remember a 10-year-old. You know, they can remember being 10 years old. So if that connection is there, it makes sense then that on some level, probably a subconscious level, some kind of intuition of the future can come through. And so this idea of quantum consciousness, I think, is very, very powerful. You know, the idea that we're all connected, that we have access to the past and the future, not just the past that happened, but the past that didn't happen, and also the future that may happen versus the future that may never happen, you know. So we can, in our mind, we can experience all the different spectrums of all the possible pasts, possible presents, and possible futures. And it's up to each of us to decide what kind of path we want to follow.
We are getting close to the end of the show, but do you want to plug your Inner Circle weekly lessons that you, are they seminars?
Yeah, that's right. Well, my book is called Mind, Time, and Power, and it's available worldwide on Amazon. And my website is mindtimeandpower.com. If people go to that website, they can read about me, and they can read about my theory. They can read about my book. And also, there's a free one-month mind power course that they can access just simply by filling in their email address, and I'll send them this 1 month course. It's 10 lessons. They get a lesson every 3 days, and they'll learn about the past, the present, and the future. They'll learn about the law of attraction and visualization and goal setting. And they'll develop, hopefully, over a period of 30 days, they'll develop a little more ability at using their mind power effectively to create more of what they want in their life.
I would like to thank Anthony Hamilton for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Thank you so much, Robert and Pilliater. It's been a real pleasure to meet the two of you online here.